The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Welcome all to this place of love and justice, this place where we attempt to live up to humanity's highest ideals, highest hopes. Do we fail? Yes, we do, often. Do we try again? Yes, we do, always, because we are people looking out for each other, all others, and the planet. Welcome all to this place of love and justice, to this gathering where the sacred and the holy are our being together. The sacred and the holy are our being together. That is the truth which we strive to witness to each morning, and the truth which I hope to embody today. I'm Reverend Andrew Weber, minister among ministers, theologian among theologians, and I'm honored to be part of the divine which we manifest, which we create today, this morning. Your presence here, virtually, in person, the presence of those around you, is the sacred and the holy. While we might be able to say that gathering in a place of love and justice is an embodiment of the sacred, it takes work to move that feeling into our hearts. Thus we come together with music, with spoken word, with story, with prayer, with silence. Let us experience the truth of our own welcome. Let us experience the creation that our welcome is in our own beings. Come, let us gather together. Come, let us worship together. As Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists do across the continent and around the globe, we mark the start of our holy times together with the lighting of a chalice. It's done. Yeah. This is the symbol of our living, life-changing, and love-promoting faith. I've asked a new member, Laura, to come forward and light our chalice. We light this flame for our faith, for the ideals we hold. We light this chalice for you with these words. Whether you are from the south, the east, the north, or the west, whether you were born into this faith, found it, or it found you, whether you feel at home or are still trying to find your place, whether you believe in God, are open to mystery, or still have no idea, whether you are unemployed, underemployed, cobbling things together, overworking, or in school, whether you are holding anxiety, grief, confusion, anger, hope, restlessness, or deep peace, Unitarian Universalism has a place for you. It is right here. And this chalice is lit for you. Each week, we, Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, light a second chalice, a second flame, acknowledging our hope for peace in our hearts and for peace in the world. Please respond with the words on the screen. May peace be with us, with all the people of the world. Thank you, Laura. We are going to have live music today, which is wonderful, which is fantastic. I'm so glad that Matt's been able to join us. And our first hymn is not in our hymnal, our hymnals. For hymns going on, there are two hymnals, gray and teal, and they're in the back if you want them physically. We also have the lyrics on the screen. But this one is Draw the Circle Wide, which we have had played the last 2 weeks. So hopefully you're like, okay, I've heard this. I know this a little bit. And if you don't, follow along. Jerry will lead us. Thank you, Jerry and Matt.
As a word this several times, as a prelude, as a postlude, right? And so I think we're ready to sing it, right? Okay.
This Not is my first time playing it.
Thank you.
Sadness and in your grief, all the pain it seems, there's no relief. We will hold you until the storm subsides. Draw the circle wide. Draw the circle wide. Draw the circle wide. No one stands alone, we'll stand side by side. Draw the circle wide.
Thank you. I think that went spectacularly. I have a story to share with you. And if anyone, under maybe 4'7" wants to come forward. And of course, if you're taller than that, you may also come forward. But I'm especially looking at those little people in the back. If you want to come forward to see the story, I'm going to sit here. It will also be on the screen behind me, so you're more than welcome to view it there. This is called Are Your Stars Like My Stars? Hey, how's it going? Hi, good morning. You can sit here or here. Yeah, if you sit there, then I can just read it. Oh, well, hello there, children. Yeah, all right, can everyone see? Are Your Stars Like My Stars? We look at the world every day, you and me. Do we see the same things? Do you see what I see? When you squint at the sky, do you see the same hue? Deep, wide, and open is your blue, like my blue. When the sun gazes down, shining yellow and bold, is it warm, full of sparkle? Is your gold like my gold? When you dig in the dirt, planting seeds in the ground, is it earthy and rich? Is your brown like my brown? I may have skipped a page, that is possible. I didn't skip a page, okay. Okay, all right, great. Oh my gosh, here we go. Here's green, is that better? Do you splash in a puddle when the world is washed clean? Are the leaves fresh and bright? Is your green like my green? When you stroll in an orchard, do sweet smells fill your head? Is the fruit bold and flashy? Is your red like my red? Does your shadow grow long as the sun starts to sink? Are the clouds soft and rosy? Is your pink like my pink? When your eyes are shut tight, do you peek just a crack? Is the night smooth and sleepy? Is your black like my black? When you stare at the stars, do you see the same light? Does it glow in the darkness? Is your white like my white? We look at each other every day, you and me. Do we see the same things? Do I see what you see? So that's, are your stars like my stars? And as you think, and as we think about what different people see and how it may be the same or different, we're going to sing our recessional hymn, and you can go off to your classes. Thanks for joining me.
Go now in peace, go now in peace. May the love of God surround you everywhere, everywhere.
I have a reading today. Sometimes I have a reading, sometimes not. Sometimes long and short. I mean, you know that if you've come here, or if I've even talked to you and said, they're all different. Every Sunday is different. Today is a little bit longer, so I'm going to give you a reading from Psychology Today, and then Matt's going to have a little musical interlude to give you time and space. So it's not just me talking, but also to have these ideas and these thoughts sort of rumble around, bounce around, and see how they settle with you. This is from Three Things You Need to Know About Perspective Taking in Psychology Today. In 1956, Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget conducted an experiment to identify the age at which children first learn to see the world through another person's eyes. He built models of three different mountains, one with a cross on top, one covered in snow, and one with a tiny hut at the crest. And he walked several children around the table to allow them to take in the whole scene. Then he sat one down at a table and produced a doll, which he set in another location so that only one or two of the model mountains was visible. And he asked the children to indicate what they believed the doll could see from the doll's vantage point. He did this experiment with kids of different ages, and the results showed real differences. Children up to 4 years old usually said the doll's perspective on the mountains would match their own. But 7 or 8 year olds could consistently identify the correct perspective the doll would have on the mountain scene. This experimental design, which came to be known as the Three Mountains Task, helped Piaget conclude that up to 4 years old, children were predominantly egocentric or mentally limited to their own points of view. And after age 8, though, as Piaget stated, taking another person's point of view became more possible. And since that time, the original experiment has been repeated and its results have been upheld. And if you really want, I have references so I can show you, like, well, where was this done? These days, however, the relevant question about perspective taking is not when does it start, but really something more like when does it stop? It's not difficult to generate examples of the ease with which people fail to take on other points of view. Think of the last argument you had with a close friend, a family member or a romantic partner. When they reacted with irritation or anger to something you said, did you take a moment to consider how they might be right from their point of view? Did you see yourself in their perspective in that moment? Or perhaps consider the nation as a whole, which is so often described as more divided than ever. How often do persons in one political party take the perspective of the other, of the very people whose ideas they find so distasteful? When confronted with a disagreement or a conflict, it's too easy to dig in, defend yourself, and reaffirm in your own mind why your point of view is the correct one. But consider what you're losing in such a scenario. Assuming that the other party, the person who disagrees with you, is acting in good faith, perhaps there is some kernel of truth in their reaction. Do they see you in a light in which you would prefer not to be seen? Why not? Are they unwittingly probing at a sensitive area or bringing up a topic that always provokes you in some way? What might it be and why? Or perhaps their reaction is more about them than it is about you. Have you, in fact, triggered a defensive response with your choice of words? Have you brought up something hurtful? Are you making assumptions about your relationship with which the other party may disagree? When faced with the opportunity to see things from a new point of view, you should also know what you might gain. First, taking another person's perspective can be highly educational. It's always wrong to believe that you personally know it all. Other people, even those with whom you disagree, are likely to possess some information that you do not know. Tuning into their perspectives can help you learn something new. Furthermore, by taking in the information relied upon by others, you may be able to deepen your own perspective in the world. Remember the children looking over Piaget's table with its mountainous landscapes? Each side of the table showed one distinct side of this three mountain vista, but none showed the full bird's eye view or a picture of everything. Put two sides, two perspectives together, and you're closer to knowing and seeing everything that's on display. And lastly, and perhaps the most important aspect of perspective taking, is to know that it's associated with empathy. Tuning in to the outlook of another person, trying to see the world through their eyes, is not far from trying to feel their feelings and understand why they feel the way they feel. These days, it's altogether too common to find yourself in the company of people who disagree with you. Next time this happens, then, instead of rejecting what they have to say, try a little bit harder to see from their point of view, based on what you know about their experience. You might confirm, deepen, or modify your own beliefs. You might be able to build empathy. In any case, you'll almost always be able to learn something new. And there ends our reading. There is a truth that we all need to recognize. All humans are not created equal. Our families of origin have different amounts of money. They have varying means of providing support or not. The education we receive is based on geography, on finances, time, access. The ability of each physical body is diverse. Not all of us can play professional sports, right? Not all of us can walk up the stairs to the post office. And this litany could take up the entire service, of course. I mean, I could go on. You could all add examples listing out the ways that we are different, including race, sex, gender, identity, relationship status, age, height. But the truth I mentioned was not that humans are all unique. It is that we are not equal. The problem is that many of our personal attributes and identities impact the value that we and others place on ourselves. This country was founded on the equality of all its citizens, founded on an ever-shifting and growing understanding of what equality and what citizenship meant. but still holding a kernel of that equality at its core. So when it becomes clear that much of our society is not fair, something has to be done. And I'm talking about the civil rights movement, women's suffrage, women's liberation, Black Lives Matter, the Americans with Disabilities Act, legalization of same-sex marriage. All of these movements coming from reimagining what a more perfect union is. Right? We constantly take the ideals of our founding fathers, there were fathers, and update them for our current understandings now. They held some truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Okay, well, that didn't include men of color. That didn't include men who didn't own land. It didn't include women, right? Or any list of host of other people who didn't fit into their group. Not to mention the overt religious language in a country based on the freedom of belief. Okay. So there have been some problems. There's a learning curve here in our country around fairness, justice, and equity. And recently, people have started to recognize inequity in higher education, in employment, where people of European ancestry are overrepresented in more prestigious schools, higher paying jobs, where being female earns you less money than a man with the same qualifications, where power remains, right? Power remains right where it began, with the straight white guy, the straight white man. And beginning with the civil rights movement in the 1960s, initiatives have been put in place hoping to address some of this discrimination. If you want, you can actually go further back. I learned this while I was studying. You can go to directly after the Civil War, so like 1870s, with government programs of promoting those who are at a disadvantage. Veterans, people with disabilities, in the 1870s. And then in 1964, the U.S. Civil Rights Act prohibited discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. 1990, the ADA required employers to provide reasonable accommodations to employees with disabilities. And currently, we are in the midst of debates on affirmative action, on DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. The arguments arise specifically with the practice of schools or places of employment giving preferential treatment to people based on identities or based on their identities. The concern is that we are letting people who aren't qualified take jobs, places, advantage of those who are more qualified. Now, DEI isn't new. Right, DEI is also a really broad term. It's not just corporate diversity training or preferential hiring treatment. At its core, all of this work was imagined, was implemented to promote fair treatment. It was all implemented for fairness, especially for those who've historically been underrepresented or discriminated against. Now, for me, I look at this and a few questions come to mind. Especially recently, questions come up for me and for our culture, like about whether or not these initiatives work and whether or not they are fair. Is that training at my place of employment helpful? How many of you have had either you're starting your job or you've had something like, oh yeah, I've had a diversity training? Yeah, many. Some of you have probably led them too. Yeah. Is prioritizing people based on certain identities fair? You know what, I'm not entirely sure on either count, whether they're helpful or whether they're fair. But I do know that the past has not been fair. And maybe meeting hiring quotas is a good way to address the discrepancy in representation. That doesn't feel good on a personal level, right? Where someone might miss out on an opportunity because of their identity. But frankly, that's already the reality for so much of the population. So what do we do? What do we do? Well, this question is another idea with diversity training, especially in places of school or work, right? When you had those trainings, when you've gone through them, as many, the majority of us have, there's a view that if we learn about it, if we just learn about diversity, then institutions, individuals will shift the mindsets, the outcomes, that maybe even without the hiring or matriculation quotas, it can be an institutional organic shift, right? From personal education. If everyone learns about diversity, then we don't have to have these quotas because we'll all be more open to diversity. Well, here's one part where the data actually exists. The data exists on this. Studies have shown that diversity training does not instill a long-standing understanding of or appreciation of another person's reality. It doesn't work. In fact, some of these trainings heighten perception of division and increase feelings of resentment. Oops. Oh, darn it. And this is where I step in as a minister, because we're looking at a personal, intimate problem, a personal, intimate issue, and we're trying to address it with institutional and governmental solutions, right? When has a government telling people what to think ever worked? I don't know, right? It has to come the other way. The government has to be informed by how people think. And then the government tells us how to act, right? As a minister, I see some inherent flaws in the approach, but I still think that government intervention must exist to hold us accountable, to help us strive for equity. But policy is for action control, not ideology control, right? The problem here is that as individuals, it's very, very hard for us to imagine what living in another person's life might be like. Right? I can only imagine what life is like for you. Literally, I can only imagine that because I only know my life. I only have my perspective with which to work from. The three mountain task that the kids had shows us that when children start to imagine another perspective, when they do that, the problem is that it takes work. It takes work that sometimes we don't know exists. It takes work that sometimes we don't want to do, or it takes work that sometimes we can't do. Is your green like my green? I mean, how eloquently that's put, the speaking to the nuances and assumptions of the task. I know what green looks like, right? So I know what you see when you see green, of course. Oh, but wait, I only know what green looks like for me. Not only is my perception of color through my contact lenses, right, and through my eyes, which can be very different than yours, but it also goes through my experiences, my feelings, and my understanding of the color. The Eagles winning may give me a different view of what green means. Right? That could be positive or negative of what that green means. And even when we experience the exact same color or hue, because I can see a number of different greens here, and even when we experience the exact same color or hue, we may have different emotional reactions to it. And the reality may be very, very different. Right? Your view of this worship service and the view of the person sitting next to you may be quite different, even though it is specifically the same experience. Let me share an example. Now, this is an example from my experience, because that's all I can speak to, right? When my children were smaller, I was out walking with a stroller doing some errands. I mean, this is, imagine a father with a double stroller just walking around town, and one of my errands was mailing a package. And so I walked up to the post office. But wait, there are a half a dozen concrete steps. Okay, maybe there's a ramp around the corner. No, there's no ramp around the corner. The post office in our town is a historic building and has, as such, has a dispensation and doesn't have to abide by the ADA. Okay, so I inadvertently put myself in one small experience of the daily life of someone who uses a wheelchair or a scooter. My privilege and the injustice of architectural discrimination struck me in the face as I struggled to find a solution to napping children and daily tasks. And for that brief moment, I got it. And I say brief because, like, my one challenge, which was fairly easily overcome, I don't even remember how, I mean, I definitely got the package mailed, and my kids are here, they're fine, right? Something happened, I don't know. That was fairly easy to overcome, and that doesn't compare with a lifetime of having to live in a place not made for me. And that's the issue right there. When people with disabilities, when women, when people of color, or any other group of marginalized people are underrepresented, are marginalized, are discriminated against, it shows them that this world was not made for them. That they aren't worthy, that they don't matter. DEI works to try to undo the years, the decades, the centuries of personal offense and pain through policy and legislation, which is a movement in the right direction. But to make real change, to really live into that inclusion that our faith talks about, right, we need to start the work on an individual level. Unitarian Universalism upholds the worthiness of every person. Of every person. To say that someone isn't worthy or that they don't matter is antithetical to our faith. Our religion holds that everyone has inherent dignity. This is why the work needs to start internally. It's a spiritual, personal issue. If we say that each and every person is worthy of respect, is worthy of love, the respect and love needs to start with each person and from them move on to institutions, move on to programs, to governments, right? DEI, the dignity of human beings, systemic oppression, institutionalized discrimination, these are huge issues, right? If you were coming looking for a solution today, it's not happening. These are big issues, but I'll give you a start. This is the start, that the challenge is also the benefit here. The fact that we need to start in our hearts means that we can start the work ourselves. Because that's where it needs to happen. We can start to experience, we can start to listen to other views of the world, other realities with just as much validity and truth as our own. I can try to experience what you go through. I can try to see the green that you see. But shared experience isn't always feasible and it's not always productive. So another option is that I listen to you and that I take some time and actually hear another perspective. I'm talking about individuals whom society discriminates against. I'm also talking about you and him and her and them. Perspective taking isn't just about diversity, equity, inclusion. Perspective taking is religious imperative at the heart of our shared values of inclusion, our shared values of worthiness, right? Unitarian Universalism says that we are important, that our life matters, that we have dignity. Our religion also says that your relatives, your neighbors, the people who supported Trump, the people who vilify him, they too are important. They too matter. They too have dignity. The question is then, how do we get from saying someone or saying everyone has worthiness to living it? Okay, we're talking about seeing matters from different viewpoints, about experiencing oppression in the world, about the same colors have different hues or different meanings, but how does this get from our heads to our hearts? How do we get from here to here, right? With humility, with curiosity. I have another story. A few years ago, my wife's extended family had a gathering in England for a reunion, and some of us were out on a walk in a sort of idyllic British landscape with the rolling hills and some mist and the sheep grazing. It was wonderful, amazing. As we were walking, my father-in-law left us and he went up to an older shepherd gentleman and chatted with him. And when he came back, We turned to him and was like, what did you talk with him about? You have nothing in common. My father-in-law said, I asked him about sheep. I mean, that's it. There you have it. That's the message of today, right? Most people, you need to meet them where they are, right? Meet people where they are and engage with them where they are. It's a great first step of listening deeply, right? Of taking on perspective and moving toward understanding from that perspective taking. Ask about what someone else is interested in. Ask about their life experiences. Do you want to engage with a shepherd? Well, ask them about sheep. Someone's always looking at their phone? Ask about their apps. Not in a judgmental, what are you doing, right? I mean, oh yeah, I can, oh yeah, ask me, what are you doing on your phone again? No, not judgmental, but really come with curiosity and interest. Can you tell me more about the game you're playing? I heard on the news that TikTok was banned and then not banned. I don't know anything about it. Can you show me TikTok? What is the other person interested in? What does their life include? Ask about that and do so with interest, with acknowledgement of their humanity and their divinity. That's the theological and practical advice, right? To recognize the inherent worthiness, inherent dignity of each other, we need to be curious about each other and willing to get out of our normal and meet someone where they are. Of course there's more, right? Of course there's more. I'm not going to grok the entirety of your essence by asking you about sheep. But that's a place to start. That's a place to start. When trust starts, maybe we can get to a place where I ask you about your experiences with systemic oppression, or what voting for a certain presidential candidate meant to you, with curiosity, not judgment. Yeah, what would that look like? What would that look like if the next time you interacted with someone with a different political persuasion, the next time you notice an example of discrimination, you put your own feelings, you put your own thoughts to the side and approach with curiosity and humility? What does the policy you support mean for you? Without rebuttal, without thinking, oh, I have so many things I'd say. No, 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 just listening. I noticed something that appeared unfair. How did that make you feel? With care. With care, knowing that people aren't required to answer, right? The task is to listen without thinking of what we're going to say next, without thinking of why an experience is not valid. Just to listen. Perspective taking can be a mental exercise, right? Mental exercise, trying to understand another viewpoint. Taking it to our heart, making it an emotional exercise, makes it real. It also creates a very vulnerable position. Putting voices to differences, speaking about marginalization is hard, but it brings them both to light. And it helps with understanding. This is the work that must be done. The task is easy. The task is so hard. Live your life as if you were divine and as if you were worthy of love. Live your life as if everyone you meet also is divine and also is worthy of love. And listen to them. Listen to their truths and their lives. Amen and amen. We are singing now, When Our Heart Is in a Holy Place. The lyrics will be up here. It's in the teal hymnal, which is the skinny one. If you want one, they're in the back. And I invite you all to stand in body or in spirit.
Pray on the to the rain. Hi, I'm Nikki. I'm part of the care team here. Each Sunday, we set us apart a special time for a special ritual, an action that speaks to a larger truth. The truth is that you are important and that your life matters and that this community cares about you. Yes, even you who don't know anyone here. That is the deeper truth which we witness to by inviting anyone who has a heavy heart or a joyous heart to share. If you have something which overflows and must be shared, you will shortly have an opportunity. The ritual is a time to share so that our joys might be heightened, so that our sorrows may be lessened. Please start with your name and speak briefly into the microphone. If you are online, raise your virtual or physical hand and you will be unmuted.
We have a different song today. This is my song. It's 159 in the gray hymnal. The lyrics will be up here. I invite you to remain seated as we sing our meditative hymn.
Thank you.
Thank you for the gorgeous live music. It's very grounding and beautiful and stunning. Thank you to everybody involved with that today. Stars by Marjorie Pickthall. Now, in the west, the slender moon lies low, and now Orion glimmers through the trees, clearing the earth with even pace and slow. And now the stately moving Pleiades, in that soft, infinite darkness overhead, hang jewel-wise upon a silver thread. And all the lonelier stars that have their place, calm lamps within the distant southern sky, and planet dust upon the edge of space, look down upon the fretful world, and I look up to outer vastness unafraid, and see the stars which sang when Earth was made.
Please rise in body or in spirit for our closing hymn. It's 134, Our World is One World. We extinguish the symbols of our faith and our hopes in the world, knowing that their extinguishing here is just a symbol, and that we hold on to this faith, that we keep it alive in the greater world. This is the mission of our faith, to teach the fragile art of hospitality, to revere both the critical mind and the generous heart, to prove that diversity need not mean divisiveness, and to witness to all that we must hold the whole world in our hands. Amen, and blessed be.